WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Building and maintaining prisons has become a booming business. The first for-profit prison was built in 1983. Now there are more than 150 of them. But prisons aren't just profitable for the companies that run them. They can boost the local economy and offer a lucrative market to product manufacturers. Journalist Joseph Hallinan has written a new book about how the merger of punishment and profit is reshaping prison culture and the economy of prison towns. The book is called Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation, and it's based on his visits to prisons around the country. Hallinan is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's written about the criminal justice system for nearly a decade. I asked him how a prison can help the local economy.
It provides a number of tremendously stable jobs. If you open up a prison of, say, a prison that holds 500 inmates, you might employ perhaps, depends on the prison, 1,000 people, either directly or indirectly, as guards, as doctors, as nurses, as administrators. And then there's a spinoff effect. The prison, for instance, has to buy food from somewhere. So the local restaurant or the local food distributor, he gets the business. The prison has to be built, so the local contractor, he gets the business. The landscaping around the prison has to be maintained. If the inmates don't do that, then a landscape company has to do that. A prison just generates a tremendous number of jobs and injects tremendous amounts of money into the economy.
Has something changed that communities used to be afraid of having a prison in their area, and now a lot of places want a prison because it's good for business?
Something did change. People began to look at prisons not as this horrible place that might drive down the economy, drive down home values, but actually as a social good. They began to see it as, a place where they could punish inmates and that did society a larger good. And then very narrowly, they began to see it as a place that could do them good. You had, in the 1980s, a number of events happen. You had many heavy industry plants in the United States close because of competition by the Japanese. You had many military bases close. You had a number of other factors go on that sucked out many solid, good-paying jobs out of the small, remote communities in America. Suddenly, these people were desperate for jobs to keep their young people around, to keep their towns vibrant. They shopped around, and one of the few things they could find was prisons.
You visited a couple of prisons in Beeville, Texas, which is in South Texas. How have the prisons in Beeville affected the economy there? Beeville has a population of 13,000, and you say 7,200 of those people are inmates.
Right, correct. The people I talked to in Beeville actually seemed to prefer the prison to the naval base. They thought the jobs were much more stable. They thought that the prisons would not go anywhere the way the naval base did when a number of bases around the United States were closed. And the income spread all the way around the town. The guy who ran the local Mexican restaurant, he had much more business. He added on to his place. The former judge who owned the pawn shop thought his business had grown tremendously. The furniture shop in town, they said their business was good. Everybody was very happy with this. I had even teachers from the local schools who had quit their jobs and gone to work in the prison. They said the pay was better, the hours were shorter, and they said the stress was less, believe it or not.
The prisoners in Beeville have to work in the fields, in plantation-style jobs.
They do, very much so. I went to the Garza units one morning about 7 o'clock, shortly before dawn, and went behind the prison where the inmates are lined up. They're all wearing their white uniforms with green quilted jackets, and they line up two by two, and they're searched and inspected and then carried out into the field on a trailer behind a tractor. Guards on a horseback trot next to them. The guards have either pistols shoved into their belts. There is one guard called a high rider who rides off from the other guards with a rifle, a 30-30, I believe. And his job is to shoot any inmates that escape. And the inmates are then unloaded into the field, given their tools. In this case, it was a tool called the Aggie, which is kind of a thresher, if you will. And they set out to work. And as they work, they sing. And the songs they sing are old slave songs, which is odd because not all the inmates are black. Many, of course, are white and Hispanic, and yet the songs they sing go back directly to plantation songs. And this has been documented by a number of musicologists who went to the Texas prison systems back in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, recorded the songs the inmates sang then as they worked, and they're almost virtually identical to the songs they sing now.
And is this considered constructive work? Is this considered punishment, reform?
I think maybe a few people thought there might be some reformative qualities in a day of hard labor, but I think primarily punishment. The work I saw really didn't need to be done. For instance, it was clearing ditches and cutting weeds, work which you can do with machines. You don't need to have 100 shackled inmates under armed guard out in the field to do that kind of work.
Let's look at an example of a high-tech prison that you visited. How about Pelican Bay Prison in Crescent City, California? This prison has 7 layers of security to prevent escape. Why don't you describe that security?
It's extremely elaborate, and much of it you can't really see. As with many prisons, in fact, if you look at them just to the naked eye, you can't really see a lot of the security that's involved. Only once you get inside the prison do you realize how really secure and, in Pelican Bay's case, really dangerous many of them are.
What do you see inside?
When I walked in Pelican Bay, for instance, I was walking around through one of the buildings with a number of guards, and I saw a large building which was initially designed to be a gymnasium, but because of overcrowding, they were turning it into bunk bed cell spaces. And I saw a large board on the wall that looks something like a blackboard, but kind of rubbery. And I noticed some smudges on it. I turned to one of the guards and I asked him, "What's with the board?" And he said, "That's a warning shot board." And I looked at him and I said, "A warning shot board? What do you mean?" He said, "That's where we fire warning shots. The board was actually made of rubber to absorb the bullets when fired inside. If the inmates in the cell block were to act up, the guards would open fire with live ammunition, first at the warning shot board, and then if the inmates didn't behave, they'd lower their guns and aim them at the inmates." And only then do you really get a feel for just how very, very dangerous a place like that is. And they've had a number of inmates killed there.
What are some of the other aspects of high-tech security at this prison?
If you go deep into the prison, the most secure place is a place known as the Security Housing Unit, SHU, or SHU as it's pronounced. And you walk in there, and it's almost like walking into an intensive care ward at the hospital. I was recently in a hospital and sat at a nurse's station and watched as they monitored EKG devices and small little screens, and that is exactly what the guards do. They're completely encased in a booth, somewhat akin to an FAA control tower, if you can imagine that, with glass all the way around. And they have a number of screens that that are attached to cameras which monitor inmates in their cells, so they can flip a switch and see who's doing what at any given time. The lights are down low. People speak in whispers. And all the cells are electronically controlled. You don't see anybody out in the hallways. You don't really detect much movement at all. Everything is structured, so there's very little guard-inmate interaction. You don't have guards talking to inmates. The inmates are shackled virtually everywhere they go when they do leave the cells. And it's very white. It's very quiet. There's virtually no kind of stimulation at all. If you're inside the cell, it's blank walls. Outside the cell, it's blank walls. And that's the way many people spend years upon years of their lives.
What are supposed to be the advantages of the new high-tech prisons?
A couple. I guess the one that gets stated most often is that they're efficient. Many times these high-tech prisons allow prisons to watch a number of inmates with fewer guards. Five guards in an old prison, for instance, would be needed to watch inmates, whereas in some of the high-tech prisons, maybe only one is needed because of the use of cameras and other devices. But as I went to a number of these prisons, they seemed to me to be intentionally punitive, and the people who run them acknowledge that with fewer guards around, they're able to deny inmates any type of interaction, and the inmates sit alone in their cells, and this is used as pressure to make the inmates conform.
Is there any way of knowing the psychological impact that these super maximum high-tech prisons have on the inmates?
I don't know of any quantitative studies, but a number of these prisons have produced lawsuits, and I talked to the people who are involved in them. And almost to a person, the psychiatrist who go in there described them as mentally debilitating. They would find inmates who smear themselves with their own feces, who cut themselves and drew or smeared blood on the walls, people who were babbling, people who were incoherent. And the prisons, interestingly enough, didn't really deny this. In fact, in TAMS, they were pretty open that they were about pushing an inmate to his breaking point, and that was an intentional device that they would be using to change his behavior.
Do you get the impression that the super maximum prisons are more for the convenience of the guards than they are for the future of the prisoners?
You know, it's very interesting trying to figure out the purpose of the supermaxes. They vary from place to place. I went to Virginia where they were building a supermax at a place called Wallens Ridge, a mountain town that's way down in the very toe of the state. As many supermaxes are, they're almost always in very, very remote places. And I asked a number of people what the purpose of the prison was, what you're trying to accomplish here. And at first, they would tell me, well, this is for the worst of the worst, which is a phrase that gets used quite a bit. And you press them on that and say, well, who exactly is the worst of the worst? And you found over time that definition changed. And as it changed, it became more lenient and more lenient and more lenient. Until you had people in these supermax prisons who were serving relatively short terms, say 5 years, for nonviolent offenses. As criminals go, that's hardly among the worst of the worst. And as I talked to the folks, I began to think that the supermax served as some sort of proxy for society exacting its revenge on the inmates, that these were very, very tough places, and they were designed to be very tough. And the public felt good that these inmates were having a very rough time of it, that they weren't in prisons that were perceived to be very lenient places, places where inmates had the run of the place and could watch TV, order Playboy magazine, pump iron, do all these things that get a lot of taxpayers very upset.
So you can't do that stuff at the super maximum security prisons?
Generally, no. You are. Imagine yourself in a room about the size of a twin bed where you can touch both walls with your outstretched arms, where it's not much longer than you are tall, so that when you lie down on a bed, your feet very nearly touch the wall. And that's it. That's your home. That's your home for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. That is all you see of the world. No sky, no sun, nothing like that. It can drive you to the point of madness.
Joseph Hallinan is my guest. His new book is called Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. And this new book is about prisons, or the so-called prison industrial complex. Hallinan writes for The Wall Street Journal. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Wall Street Journal reporter Joseph Hallinan. His new book about prisons in America is called Going Up the River, and he's traveled to many prisons around the country reporting on conditions there. How do for-profit prisons make their money?
It's funny. They make their money essentially just like hotels do. They build the prison. They figure out what it costs them per day to supply the room and board, the food, the guards, the maids, in essence, everything you need just like a hotel. And then they charge the state $49, $59 a day, just as you would pay for a Holiday Inn or a Motel 6 or something like that. It's very, very similar.
One of the prisons that you visited that you write about in your new book, you describe as a model for the private prison in America. This is the Great Plains Correctional Facility in central Oklahoma. How would you describe this prison?
It was, of all the prisons I visited, I think the I don't know if I want to say the best overall, but certainly it's what you'd hope for in a prison, I think. If you were to take a tour, as I did, you would see computers inside where inmates can learn a variety of skills, learn how to use Microsoft Word, programs like that. There were musical instruments they could learn to play. The cells were clean and relatively spacious. The atmosphere inside the prison was not particularly hostile, as it is in many places, and the place seemed to run fairly well. And the town, which built the prison as a speculative investment, loved it, did quite well, sold the prison, and now took the money from that and is building a golf course and housing development.
So how come there are musical instruments and computers?
Largely to keep the inmates pacified. It's every warden will tell you, and this is the interesting thing about the debate that we've had over the last 5 years or so with the so-called get tough on crime mentality. You see a number of legislatures saying, take away the weights, take away the TVs, lock these inmates up, give them nothing to do all day because they deserve it because they did very bad things. It's true in many cases they did do very bad things. But what ask any warden, ask any guard, and what they will tell you is that makes their job 10 times tougher because a grown man who's locked away for 24 hours a day, who has no TV to watch, no weights to lift, nothing to do with his time, is an extremely dangerous person. And the atmosphere inside the prisons becomes extremely hostile and people get hurt.
One of the points you make in your book, Going Up the River, is that prisons mean money now in a lot of places. If a prison comes to a town, then more people will move there because there's more jobs, there'll be more restaurants opening, more supermarkets, gas stations, and so on. So, you know, prisons are connected with money. There's also companies that are making money by selling their products to prisons. One example is phone companies. I guess, you know, you used to not be able to make many phone calls as a prisoner, but now you say all prisons have this really big bank of pay phones.
It's amazing. The thing about a prison is it's essentially a small town, a city, and it needs everything a city does. So when you open a prison, you need doctors, you need nurses, you need a guy to fix the computer, you need somebody to haul the trash, you need all those things the city needs. And so every time a prison opens, all these people get hired. And of course, inmates, to a degree, need the same things that you or I need. They need toothpaste and deodorant and shampoo, and they need to make phone calls. And the phone companies in this country, AT&T, MCI, WorldCom, folks like that, were very quick to catch on to this. And in the early 90s, they began approaching the prisons with profit-splitting deals where they would come to the prison and say, hey, let us put in phones, and every time an inmate makes a collect call home, you get 50 cents of the dollar, we get 50 cents of the dollar. And this became extremely big business for these companies.
So did that change prison policy about how many phone calls an inmate could make?
Oh, absolutely. You would routinely in the 60s, 70s, and even in the 80s, see prison policies where the phone was used as a reward. And if an inmate behaved, he might get 5 minutes a week on the phone or 5 minutes a month or maybe even only 5 minutes every 90 days. And the phone was used as a reward for that behavior. But as soon as there was profit to be made, the phone was no longer used as a reward. It changed, and inmates were allowed to use the phone basically anytime they could. Anytime they weren't working or weren't in school or in their cells, they're free to get on the phones and talk as long as they like because the prison was making money on it.
You visited prisons around the country. You've observed prisoners around the country. Do you worry a lot about what it will be like for these prisoners when they're released back into the world outside and what it will be like for the people who they're interacting with?
I do, particularly for the inmates who are confined in the so-called supermax prisons. In many cases, the inmates who are assigned to these prisons, as I said, will spend years in a solitary cell, literally not much bigger than a twin bed. And you will take an inmate like that, and in many cases, he will be released straight onto the street at the end of his term. He's not put in a medium security prison and then a minimum security prison and slowly worked toward freedom. One day he's in a cell 5x7, the next day he's out in the free world. And I don't know about you or anybody else, but the prospect of walking next to someone like that, sitting next to someone like that, passing someone like that on the street, I think is very frightening. Prospect just to release people like that. On the other hand, some prison systems, Iowa is one that's particularly noteworthy, I think, have tried to encourage inmates to get jobs while they're in prison with the for-profit sector, with real companies. And they do this under one condition, that the companies that employ them, if the employees do well, they offer them jobs when they get out. And they've had some success with that. I spoke with one woman who had been in prison for 16 months on a bad check charge, and she was 45 years old. And I asked her about this. She worked in a plant where they basically packaged dry powdered goods, something like Kool-Aid. And she made, I think, $7.50 to start. And she told me that she was so incredibly grateful for this job, because what it allowed her to do when she got out of prison was to have a big enough savings account. I think she had $1,800 that allowed her to put a deposit on an apartment and a down payment on a car and a real small amount of money in a checking account, and basically allowed her to get on with her life. If she hadn't had that in Iowa, she would have gotten, she would have received, I believe, $100 and a one-way bus ticket, and that would have been it. And that's precious little to start a life over again.
Joseph Hallinan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Joseph Hallinan is the author of Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. This is Fresh Air.